Welcome to the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. I'm your host, David Yosifon, Associate Professor of Law at Santa Clara University School of Law here in sunny Santa Clara, California. It is sunny today, a touch cold, but of course when we say cold here in the Bay Area, we mean that you might want to wear a long sleeve shirt. On the podcast today, we're going to be discussing the problem of corporate corruption, or perhaps the problem with the solution to corporate corruption. My guest for this episode is Professor Mike Kaler from Southern Illinois School of Law. Mike is an expert in the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and has an acclaimed book on the subject called The Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in a New Era. And he runs a website, fcpaprofessor.com. He's one of the nation's leading authorities on this bedrock statute that endeavors to regulate corporate corruption. And I'm just thrilled to have him as a guest on the podcast today. Thank you so much for joining us, Mike.
And thanks for having me.
So, Mike, give us a brief introduction to the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. I'm not a big acronym guy, but you really can't get it around it in this subject. So we will refer to the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act as the FCPA. And it really is the basic statute that regulates foreign corruption of U.S. corporations. Can you describe the FCPA? Tell us a little bit about the history, where it comes from, and what it endeavors to do.
Yeah, sort of a high-level overview is that in the mid-1970s, Congress learned of a wide variety of payments, not only domestically in connection with the Watergate scandal, but abroad as well. And these payments were to a wide variety of recipients for a wide variety of reasons and occurred for, a variety of reasons. Congress, was most concerned with the foreign policy aspects of this, given that many of the so-called foreign corporate payments involved traditional government officials like the Prime Minister of Japan, the President of Gabon, the President of Honduras, Italian political parties, so on and so forth. And the main concern of Congress was the foreign policy impact these payments were having. In other words, foreign governments, foreign political leaders were being held accountable to the corporations because of the improper payments, rather than to the State Department, the Defense Department, the White House, et cetera, et cetera. To be sure, there were other motivations Congress had in passing the FCPA. So-called post-Watergate morality was certainly part of the equation, but foreign policy was certainly the main motivation of Congress. So that's kind of how we got this statute in 1977.
I think it's just a fascinating history to it that I think has been lost in many contemporary academic or public policy conversations about the FCPA. That is, that there is this competition between the private sector and the government for influence over foreign officials. And by the 1970s, international business operations are actually outpacing in some ways government in their effort to garner influence or to have influence abroad. And so to restrain that activity, the government does what it can do, which is to pass law restricting that kind of business practice. Was the corruption of foreign officials to generate business a widespread practice in international trade for the 1970s, or was it becoming a big problem in the 70s?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I agree that the story of the FCPA is very fascinating and indeed very relevant today. And given that the FCPA practice from a practitioner standpoint and given the increased enforcement is a relatively new phenomena, I think all would be well served to review the FCPA's history. And upon the FCPA's 35th anniversary a couple of years ago, I wrote an article, The Story of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, that is a very extensive articulation of sort of the high-level stuff I just talked about. I mean, you know, there's been corruption since man existed. But, you know, when you think about it, let's just generically say it was really only in the post-World War, II environment where U.S. companies, started doing an extensive amount of business, abroad, including, from the oil and gas, perspective in relatively high-risk jurisdictions and certainly from a defense contractor standpoint, World War II and the aftermath resulted in U.S. companies seeking, sales abroad, so on and so forth. So, corruption has always existed, but, I think given the expansion in markets and corporations really need not so much, choice to satisfy shareholder demand for profits in emerging markets has resulted in this being, really a high priority and important statute for all companies, regardless of industry sector, regardless if they're public or private companies, doing business abroad.
And so you say that the kind of moralistic justification that's given that it's broadly wrongful for American corporations to be engaging in paying bribes and perpetuating, patronizing corruption in foreign governments by paying bribes to have access to markets and opportunities abroad, that has been an element of the FCPA, but perhaps more of a window dressing that's masking other dynamics.
And having read the legislative history in total, not once, but twice, but three times, that's my firm conclusion. I mean, certainly, Congress is a political actor, and there is, to a certain extent, this post-Watergate morality in the legislative history. But again, I think the foreign policy motivation was clearly the main motivation. And, one thing that's really interesting about the legislative history as well is there was not a consensus within our government as to what to do about this problem. Indeed, the State Department and the Defense Department were viewed as enablers of and indeed actual participants in some of the problematic payments Congress learned of. And, let's face it, we have a fair amount of corruption here in the United States. We tend to call it and label it differently. But, Congress was well aware that we were not immune from some of these same issues. And, another interesting thing about the legislative history, which really brings us into the current new era of enforcement, is Congress could have legislated as to a wide, wide variety of payments that it learned of. But it chose to address in the FCPA only a relatively narrow category of payments. And those were payments to a specific recipient category, in other words, foreign officials, for a specific purpose, to obtain or retain business. And then the FCPA has always, at least initially in an indirect way, but as a result of the FCPA's 88 amendments, more expressly exempted so-called facilitation or grease payments that merely motivated a foreign official to do what they otherwise should have been doing, such as issuing licenses, permits, etc. So this notion that you frequently see today, and indeed one advanced by the DOJ and the SEC who enforce this statute, that Congress intended to broadly capture any and all problematic payments, it's just, flat out false.
So do I understand you right that the basic framework is it's unlawful to bribe an official to do something that is unlawful for that official to do. But if you're paying that official to actually effectuate what they're supposed to be doing anyway, then that's not corruption, and that kind of payment, generally speaking, is permissible.
Well, the statute says it's exempted from the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act anti-bribery provisions, but one of the interesting things we see in this new era is that many enforcement actions arguably capture payments that fall under that exception. And that gets into perhaps a bigger issue of how these cases are resolved and the notion that just because a company agrees to settle an FCPA enforcement action, that therefore the statutory language has been violated. There's very little, if any, judicial scrutiny of corporate FCPA enforcement in this new era.
I definitely want to get into your critique of the enforcement of the statute. I think it's fascinating and really troubling. Let me just ask you, though, before we get there, from another very broad perspective, can you assess the impact that the FCPA has had in its history on the ability of American business to compete with other businesses around the world? Does the FCPA handicap American businesses from making profits for shareholders or delivering consumer goods to consumers because they are unable to engage in business practices that corporations or companies from other countries that are not subject to the FCPA are able to do?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer, I think, is yes, for the same reason that a speed limit handicaps a driver from going faster. You know, Congress was well aware that when they took this pioneering step in the mid-1970s, because this was the first law in the world that seeked to govern domestic companies in their interactions with foreign officials in foreign lands, you know, Congress was well aware to a certain extent that this would handicap U.S. businesses. But there's a statement in the legislative history, something to the effect of, we know it's going to handicap U.S. businesses to some extent, but we can all sleep better at night knowing that, you know, U.S. businesses are going to get business because of the quality of their products and the competitiveness of those prices and the products. So the short answer is Congress always knew this was the case. I think that argument or position, though, has certainly faded in this new era, because when the FCPA was passed, the United States was really the only country in the world with a law like this. And beginning approximately 10, 15 years ago, more and more countries have adopted FCPA-like laws, to the extent that now there's approximately 40 countries with FCPA-like laws on their books. Now, just because a law is on the book doesn't mean that it's going to be actively enforced, but perhaps another topic we can get into is how comparing FCPA enforcement to, for instance, a foreign country's enforcement of FCPA-like laws is really an apples-to-oranges comparison.
Well, do you see the proliferation of FCPA-like legislation in other countries as being motivated by that same competition between the government and the private sector, or more being motivated by the development of international norms of business that see corruption as being an unethical and undesirable business practice that should be legislated out?
More the latter, and I would even say that it's largely been a political response, because there's some civil society organizations in this space that you know, have basically adopted a shaming approach over the last 5-10 years that have resulted in countries either writing a new law and putting it on their books for the first time, or changing their laws. And, you know, on one level, there's nothing wrong with that, but some of my criticisms of some of these civil society organizations is they seem to be pounding the pavement for more enforcement, as if more enforcement, regardless of outcome or regardless of resolution vehicle or regardless of enforcement theory, is an inherent good. Well, you know, as law professors, I think we perhaps need to hit a pause button there and remind folks that, you know, quality of enforcement should take a priority over quantity of enforcement.
You have written extensively about the quality or lack thereof in the enforcement of the FCPA. So can you describe some of your central criticisms of how the regime has been effectuated?
Yeah, I mean, I think I often get, and I know I have been labeled this way, as the anti-FCPA professor, as if I'm against the statute, which nothing could be further from the truth. There's a fundamental difference between what the FCPA says and how the FCPA has been enforced. And to you and I and other sophisticated legal minds, I guess you could say that's a pretty basic point, but I think that gets lost on a lot of people, that a statute can be on the books but yet enforced in aggressive and unique ways. So as to the statute itself, yeah, I think the statute perhaps could be improved, particularly through a compliance defense that I've long advocated and many others have as well.
In other words, if you have endeavored to in good faith to comply and you've got systems in place, then that should be some kind of a safe harbor.
Yes, and a very relevant point here is that a compliance defense to the FCPA passed the House in the mid-80s, but obviously did not come up part of the statute. And another relevant point is that the FCPA, like law of many of these foreign countries, have compliance defense concepts embedded in them. But my main critique, and I began talking about this in 2010 through my article, The Facade of FCPA Enforcement. I talked about these issues, to be sure, in my 2010 Senate testimony when the Senate held an FCPA hearing, is that in many cases FCPA enforcement has gone off the rails, and what has facilitated it going off the rails is there's no judicial scrutiny as a practical matter in most all corporate FCPA enforcement actions. And the reason for that is approximately 10 years ago, the Department of Justice brought to the FCPA context non-prosecution and deferred prosecution agreements. And in this new era, and that's not a term I came up with, but rather the Department of Justice declared a new era of FCPA enforcement in November of 2010, approximately 85% of all corporate enforcement actions involve NPAs and DPAs, which means that there's no judicial scrutiny at all as to the enforcement theories, the facts, the evidence, what have you.
Can you just describe what that is a little bit more, the non-prosecution agreement? So the DOJ launches an investigation and ultimately comes to some satisfactory resolution that might involve the payment of a fine, but does not result in any kind of admission of guilt or any kind of judicial scrutiny of the investigation, and it's kind of settled between the DOJ and the company like that. Is that right?
Yeah, in part, although the DOJ rarely, quote, launches investigations, because this perhaps is a even broader issue, but the vast majority of corporate FCPA enforcement actions are based upon voluntary disclosures, in which I think it's accurate to say the DOJ merely processes the corporation's voluntary disclosure. But that perhaps is a different issue. An NPA is simply a letter agreement between counsel for the company and the Department of Justice. Mm-hmm. In often cases, the factual allegations can be as short as 2 to 3 pages. Basically, the Department of Justice says, hey, company, you violated the FCPA. And in exchange for paying X millions of dollars, we won't prosecute you. Now, these agreements, while public, never reach the inside of a courtroom because they're non-prosecution agreements. So in other words, the Department of Justice plays the role, I guess you could say, of judge, jury, prosecutor, all at the same time. And, of course, companies have the option of saying, well, no, we disagree with your factual analysis, or we disagree with your legal interpretation. But let's not forget, in order for a company to do that, they would need to be criminally charged. Mm-hmm. And the mere hit on the company's market capitalization upon that happening would be far exceeding whatever a fine or penalty amount may be in an FCPA enforcement action. Mm-hmm. A deferred prosecution agreement, I guess you could say, is a close cousin to an NPA. Deferred prosecution agreement does have the look and feel of a pleading. It is at least filed in court, but the charges, hence the name, are never actually prosecuted. They're deferred. And essentially, if the company behaves itself for anywhere from an 18-month to maybe a 3-year period, the charges go away, and it's like nothing ever happened. Mm-hmm. And you know, again, risk-averse companies, and I was an FCPA lawyer for 10 years prior to becoming a law professor. I sort of know how this happens. Risk-averse companies, you know, 99% of corporate boards in America are going to agree to these alternative resolution vehicles, you know, rather than put the DOJ to its burden of proof. Indeed, in the, what are we now at, 37-year history of the FCPA, only two companies have ever put the DOJ to its burden of proof at trial, and the DOJ ultimately lost both of those cases.
That to me is just a fascinating and shocking bit of information that, and I just want to repeat that so make sure I've got it right and so the listeners hear it, make sure they caught it. In the 37-year history of the FCPA, an enforcement action against a company has only an alleged violation has only been litigated to conclusion two times in the 37-year history of the statute. Is that right?
Correct. And the DOJ lost both of those cases.
And the DOJ lost both cases. Okay. And yet, this is an enormous piece of regulatory apparatus in the way that international business is done, and a huge cost in terms of the compliance architecture that corporations have up and running in order to evade liability for the FCPA.
Yeah, now it must be stated that there have been a few more individual prosecutions. You know, individuals have a completely different risk-reward ratio or analysis than companies do. But the salient point there is the DOJ has an overall losing record in those cases as well. I mean, this has such broad legal and policy impacts sort of for the following reason. In this space, the last 2-3 years, a major issue has been who is a foreign official under the FCPA. And last May, the 11th Circuit, in a case of first impression, gave a ruling on that issue. I've been involved in these cases from day one, and I was involved in trying to convince the Supreme Court to take cert, to accept cert on this issue. Well, it didn't happen because there's no circuit split on any FCPA issue. The Supreme Court is not going to take a case just because there's one appellate court decision on an issue. The problem there, though, is because of how the DOJ and the SEC have chosen to resolve these cases, the lack of judicial scrutiny has such a macro impact where the Supreme Court, if this is how FCPA enforcement continues, will never take an FCPA case because there's no circuit split.
As a matter of fact, we see a lack of judicial scrutiny because all these matters are being resolved prior to active litigation between these companies and the DOJ. But tell us, why do you say, I take it your assessment is that that the DOJ is getting companies to pay fines for conduct that would not really be violative of the statute?
Yeah, I mean, that was the central thesis of my article 2010, The Facade of FCPA Enforcement. And just to be clear, I'm not even remotely suggesting or inferring that no company has never violated the FCPA.
Of course.
I mean,
to be
clearly
sure,
That's the case. And what do I base that statement on? Well, I base the statement upon having a very firm knowledge and understanding of what Congress intended this statute to mean. And based on the very little, judicial authority there is, in many of the cases, the DOJ or SEC have lost on some of the same theories they extract corporate settlements from on those theories.
Can you give us a few examples of kinds of behavior that you think that corporations are paying for with these non-prosecution agreements that Congress did not intend to prescribe?
Yeah, I mean, I'll divide current FCPA enforcement actions into two general categories. One is what I'll call foreign government procurement. Congress clearly intended to capture payments in connection with foreign government procurement. But in this new era, there are many cases in I'll just generically call non-foreign government procurement cases.
What is foreign government procurement? That sounds like a term of art. Can you just break that down for us?
Not so much a term of art, but a payment is in connection for some foreign government business, whether it's to sell a fighter jet to the Egyptian military or to sell, you know, computer
software. So doing business with the government,
right,
with the foreign government.
Right.
I see. Okay.
The other is what I'll call non-foreign government procurement cases. These have to do with payments in connection with navigating foreign bureaucracies, payments in connection with obtaining foreign licenses, foreign permits, foreign certifications. In other words, the alleged offending company may not be doing $1 of business with a foreign government, but needs some foreign government blessing, approval, stamp, you know, to do business in a country in the general sense. Now, not only is the legislative history clear that Congress didn't like those payments, but made the policy choice not to address those payments in the FCPA, but perhaps more important to this question is the DOJ and the SEC have been put to its burden of proof in individual cases in connection with that non-foreign government procurement theory, and have an overall losing record in those cases. Mm-hmm. But notwithstanding that, we see, you know, many cases in this new era concerning that type of conduct. Another major enforcement theory over the last 5 years or so that has been used in connection with approximately 15 corporate FCPA settlements is the notion that foreign doctors and foreign nurses and, yes, even a midwife are foreign officials and occupy a status similar to a president or prime minister. That sort of gets into the foreign official element. Mm-hmm. Well, none of those cases were subjected to any judicial scrutiny, mm-hmm. and have never, ever, ever been used in connection with an individual enforcement action. And why I think that is such an important point is it's almost like the DOJ and the SEC unleash these aggressive and flimsy enforcement theories and use them against risk-averse corporations and would not dare use them against individuals on the theory that the individual is more likely to, you know, subject and expose that flimsy aggressive enforcement theory.
And so the consequence of this aggressive, or perhaps overly aggressive, or perhaps unlawful scope of regulatory enforcement, you've insightfully argued, is not just the actual fines that corporations are made to pay to the DOJ or that agree to pay, but that there are substantial ripple effects that get into what I think of in my head as the FCPA industrial complex.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the ripple effects so we can begin to understand the costs,
yeah,
of this regulatory regime?
Well, as to your latter point, it's a factual statement that in the last 5-7 years, there's a niche industry that I've come to call FCPA Inc., and it's literally a multi-billion-dollar industry. I mean, that's a factual statement. Now, of course, there's nothing wrong with niche industries, but, you know, when a niche industry kind of pops up very quickly, mm-hmm. For no apparent reason, it's not like the FCPA was a new law. It's not like Congress changed the law recently. It's not like a Supreme Court decision blessed various aspects of this law. It just kind of popped up. Yeah.
And what is this industry doing? What does this industry do?
Well, you know, FCPA Inc. Is just a shorthand concept to reflect that it's not just law firms, it's accounting firms, it's compliance firms, it's, mm-hmm. you know,
consultants.
I mean, even the insurance companies are now offering FCPA insurance, and it's private plaintiffs lawyers because of shareholder and derivative actions. But mm-hmm. to your original question, and indeed the sort of topic I presented on it at your law school a few weeks ago was the ripple effects of not just FCPA enforcement, but mere FCPA scrutiny. Mm-hmm. Most people, of course, are focused on fine and penalty amounts in the FCPA context. You know, it's what makes the news and so on and so forth. But You know, the main takeaway point for listeners is the fine and penalty amounts in a typical instance of FCPA scrutiny is a relatively minor component of the overall financial consequences a company will suffer. For instance, Goodyear yesterday resolved an FCPA enforcement action, and that fine and penalty amount was $16 million. Well, Goodyear was under FCPA scrutiny for about 2.5 years. And during that 2.5 years, you can bet that there was a team of lawyers and forensic accountants that were conducting an investigation and in meetings with the DOJ and the SEC, so on and so forth. And as a condition of yesterday's settlement, Goodyear has a 3-year reporting obligation to the SEC. You know, a reporting obligation may seem rather minor and trivial, but when you're a publicly traded company and you have a reporting obligation to your primary regulator, you can bet that's going to cost millions of dollars per year in lawyer fees and work. Mm-hmm. The takeaway point is it's because of these FCPA ripples, and I haven't even really talked at any level about the business impacts here, the impact on stock price, the impact on bond ratings, the impact on merger and acquisition activity. It's because of these ripple effects that I really think we need to get FCPA enforcement right. We need to make sure that if scrutiny and enforcement is that first drop of water that creates these ripples, that they're actual legitimate, bona fide, valid theories, because otherwise it's just kind of a facade that makes an entire industry rich, a facade that pretends it's doing something to, you know, eliminate bribery and corruption when that's often an open and debatable point.
And I think facade is really a great metaphor here when we talk about the social consequences of this kind of cost, because this is, it's just not socially useful activity, right? To have, these are consultants, lawyers, accountants, insurance agents that are spending, you know, creative human energy and being paid money that could be put to better use, that could actually be put to socially productive use, but it's kind of just being, it's as if we're taking, you know, steel and dumping it to the bottom of the ocean rather than making good use of it when we're spending money on the facade of FCPA regulatory activity or compliance activity.
Yeah, I mean, certainly a company ought to, upon learning of alleged improper conduct, conduct an internal investigation. That's just good corporate governance. So I'm not saying that no money should be spent on this. It's right. Just there are many, many excesses here. So, you know, for instance, Walmart's under FCPA scrutiny. Well, at one point, you know, it's now, you know, dipped a little bit because Walmart's been under FCPA scrutiny, over 3 years now. Walmart was spending $1.1 million per day. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, I know Walmart's a big company, but, you know, that's shareholder money being spent on nothing that really is advancing the company. Mm-hmm. It's just digging into, you know, conduct that may or may not have taken place to position the company to be risk averse against, you know, the DOJ and the SEC. So, you know, I'm not saying that this is, the company shouldn't be paying attention to this or should not be doing investigations or spending money on compliance. They surely should. But I think there are many excesses that define this new era of FCPA enforcement. And, you know, at the end of the day, when a company is spending money, it's shareholder money.
Some of our listeners might not be really moved to learn that Walmart shareholders are losing $1 million a day. But those listeners might conceive that this is $1 million that might be going to shareholders, might otherwise be made available for wages, or might otherwise be made available to lower prices to consumers. So, however, there's $1 million loss. You know, we can argue about the distributional consequences of it and who should be getting that million. Point is that it's $1 million that's at least by assertion here, being wasted on activity that is, you know, that is, to put it colloquially, an overkill of regulatory compliance or risk aversion. I want to ask you about the risk aversion, but actually let me ask you about this point first, that an argument that could be made to suggest that this isn't really socially wasteful. Is it possible that, the FCPA enforcement from the government, that's just one piece of ridding capitalism of corruption, ridding the world of corruption, and the fines that are paid, that's only one small piece, that having corporate culture and broad professional engagement, civil engagement in ferreting out corruption of all kinds, that while that's costly, and perhaps more costly than the statute envisioned or that Congress envisioned, it's nevertheless socially useful because it has lowered globally lowered the costs of capital accumulation, because people trust capitalism more, they trust markets more, because the ability of government to interfere with business through corrupt practices has been limited. So maybe all of this money is actually socially useful because it's facilitating capital accumulation and international exchange that otherwise wouldn't happen because of fears of corruption and actual corruption. How do you assess that claim?
Well, any conversation about corruption and bribery, and there's many revolving these topics, use the terms bribery and corruption as if there's a universal definition of what they mean. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Department of Justice and the SEC, to an extent, portray the notion of FCPA enforcement as, you know, we're trying to prevent buildings from crumbling and schools not being built and, you know, bridges from, you know, not falling. Well, the fact of the matter is, most every FCPA enforcement action is against a company that is otherwise viewed as selling the best product for the best price. Mm-hmm. In other words, there's no suggestion in yesterday's FCPA enforcement action against Goodyear that their product was inferior, or that because of the alleged bribe payments, a dangerous tire was put on the marketplace that caused a car accident. So this notion that FCPA enforcement is socially desirable because it's making the world a safer place, while one could certainly construct a hypothetical where a bridge is crumbling because of an improper payment, it's just not there in the vast, vast majority of these cases. To be sure, there have been some egregious instances of corporate bribery that no reasonable minds could object to. But many of these cases, literally the allegations are about a $4 payment, mm-hmm. and I'm not making that up, about karaoke.
A $4 payment to like a...
To a low-level ministerial African clerical official. Karaoke bars, cigarettes, flowers, fancy bottles of wine. Now, you know, we do that in this country, and we might call it effective sales and marketing. but you do that with a certain other category of customer, and the U.S. government is calling it bribery. We have such a glaring, and my next article on this topic is the uncomfortable truths and double standards of bribery enforcement. We have such a double standard in this country when it comes to defining what bribery and corruption is. In other words, we judge U.S. corporate interaction with foreign officials by a materially different standard than we judge U.S. corporate interaction with our own domestic officials. And while I may not be precisely answering your question, I think it's an important point, nevertheless, when you look at some of the big picture policy justifications that are often advanced in connection with FCPA enforcement and find that on a more micro level, they're not often there.
Your point is also that that whatever our domestic regulation is, and I hear you saying that it's a different standard than is applied through the FCPA, and our domestic apparatus is subject to judicial scrutiny because those cases get litigated, those cases get tested. But we have
if those cases are even brought, I mean, the domestic parallel to the FCPA is 18 U.S.C. 201. Well, you know, when's the last time you heard of a major company being charged or prosecuted under 18 U.S.C. 201, despite the fact that many major companies contribute to the charitable foundations of political leaders, despite the fact that and that core conduct contributing to a charitable foundation of a foreign government official has been used in several FCPA enforcement actions. So the cases aren't even brought in the domestic context.
So I want to ask you again about the risk aversion of these corporations. I guess ask you from a theoretical standpoint and a practical standpoint that if it's so, why so companies are afraid that if they get charged by the Justice Department, that it's going to have an adverse effect on their stock price, and so they resist that charge by by bribing the DOJ essentially to not have these bribery charges brought against them in connection with the FCPA. But why does the market respond that way if you're right that the DOJ is capricious or at least out of bounds in terms of what Congress intended to prohibit by the statute, why is the market so wrong in its assessment of what the implications are of the DOJ actually bringing a case? I mean, if the market's efficient, shouldn't the market see that the DOJ has no case, and once this is subject to judicial scrutiny, DOJ will lose, the company will prevail, and therefore there shouldn't be much adverse effect on the stock price? I know that's a little theoretical, but why doesn't that pan out?
Not theoretical in the least bit. It's a very good question. The short answer, I guess, is the market movers have no idea about, they're not law professors, they're not lawyers, they're just reacting to fear, they're reacting to uncertainty, and nothing could be more uncertain, I think, than a business organization being criminally charged by the DOJ or merely civilly charged by their primary government regulator, the SEC, and then having that gray cloud of uncertainty linger over the company for a year or two and be fodder for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal when the trial actually occurs. Mm-hmm. You know, the interesting thing about it is, and I'm clearly not offering investing advice on this program, but the market often overreacts.
But that's sort of what I'm thinking, is that you
often
should...
often overreact to instances of FCPA scrutiny, and wise investors would sort of buy the FCPA-induced dip, because they are relatively brief blips.
Yeah.
But when you're on the board or the audit committee, you don't even want brief blips in your stock price. I mean, you're judged by quarterly results.
Yeah, and that's an agency problem, that the directors are looking after their own reputation and their own skin, that they don't want to be associated with the FCPA news blip or the FCPA dip in the stock price, even though the long-term interests of the shareholders might be to fight this capricious FCPA charge.
Correct. And what are you buying, figuratively or literally, I guess you could say, when you get an MPA or DPA? You're buying certainty. You know this is going to end, you know how it's going to end, and you know the exact day on the calendar it's going to end. None of that is, you know, ascertainable when the big variable of putting the DOJ or the SEC to its burden of proof happens. So that's part of the reason why this has only happened twice. In other words, the DOJ being put to its burden of proof. And quite frankly, because of these alternative resolution vehicles that the DOJ brought to this context approximately 10 years ago, they make it so easy. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the companies may not have to admit any liability. It's basically just a letter agreement, so on and so forth. So, you know, it's like, why do we find ourselves in this new era of FCPA enforcement? Clearly, I think it's because of the resolution vehicles. Clearly, I think it's because of some of the aggressive enforcement theories. But there's a very credible argument to be made that it's the fault of the business organizations themselves, because let's face it, excessive risk aversion on a company-by-company level is understandable. But you start to aggregate risk-averse business decisions upon risk-averse business decisions, and you know, if you or your listeners are familiar with the tragedy of the commons, that's kind of what happens here. It's everyone's acting in their own immediate self-interest, but the aggregate effect of that is this law is being broadened, not through a normal way, but this concept of prosecutorial common law. Mm-hmm. And the DOJ and the SEC have even been apt to cite their prior settlements as being akin to precedent.
From a rule of law perspective, it's deeply troubling, and you know, it's so surprising. Well, I shouldn't be surprised, because in collateral areas, I'm always I've been teaching about some controversial aspects of Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank. That you look for judicial opinions interpreting whether the SEC has regulated outside of its authority, and you just don't see any because they never get challenged. So it is a broader statement about the administrative state.
Oh yeah, very much. And MPAs and DPAs are clearly not just used in the FCPA context, but their predominant use in terms of any single area of law is in the FCPA context. And another main difference, I think, is, you know, let's say the DOJ would resolve an insider trading case tomorrow through an MPA or DPA. Well, there's hundreds of appellate court decisions and dozens of Supreme Court decisions on the parameters of insider trading law. You know, one could literally count on one hand and have a couple fingers left over the number of substantive FCPA appellate decisions, notwithstanding the fact that we're nearing 40 years of this statute.
I want to talk to you for a minute about the public choice dynamics here. I attend a lot of conferences and symposium and public talks, and the FCPA comes up quite frequently, and you're among the first that I have heard really criticizing the FCPA. I think it's pretty easy to drink the Kool-Aid that foreign corruption must be wrong, application of the statute must be right, you know, and these enormous sums of money that companies are spending in their compliance programs and with consultants and lawyers must be money well spent. And so it's usually a celebration when we talk about the expansion of the FCPA. And so I guess this is that kind of moral glow associated with being against corruption is what makes it so difficult to reform the statute. I would expect that companies that are having to pay continually might otherwise endeavor to influence Congress to curb the DOJ activity here.
Well, there's sort of a long story here, but the criticism of FCPA enforcement has been very vocal and vibrant over the last few years, and indeed it was the Chamber of Commerce picking up on some of this in 2010 that facilitated the Senate in having its FCPA hearing in November of 2010, and the House soon followed up in June 2011. Now, certainly the Chamber of Commerce was not the first organization talking about FCPA enforcement, but just given the nature of that organization, it certainly raised it to a whole nother level. So you might ask, well, what happened? Well, what happened was a very astute political move by the Department of Justice. There was an FCPA reform bill that was just waiting to be introduced on Capitol Hill. And the Department of Justice stepped in and said, wait a minute, no need for a reform bill. We're going to issue FCPA guidance, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, this takes us up to approximately, the 2011 time frame. Well, lo and behold, it took the department, and those on Capitol Hill who were inclined to introduce a reform bill publicly stated, well, we'll hold off on this until the DOJ issues guidance. Well, to make a long story short, it took the DOJ well over a year to issue the guidance, and conveniently, the guidance was issued 1 week after the 2014 presidential election. Now, by that time, the Walmart's FCPA scrutiny had reached the front pages of the paper, and any time a divisive company like Walmart is the subject of legal scrutiny, you know, it became very difficult to have an open, honest conversation about the law because of that. This has been such an issue with the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act since day one. In other words, how can you seek to clarify or seek to amend a law called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act? It's like you know, being against the Send the Kids to School Act.
Right.
And so prominent was this that in the 1980s, there was actually attempts to change the name of this law so that in issues based, honest discussion could take place without this rhetoric of somehow you're in favor of bribery if you're seeking to amend the FCPA. So,
well, I think that might be a prudent course. You change the name, and then a couple of, you know, change the name in association with a minor tweak to the program, or even an intensification of the program, and then a few years later you come back, and then you go for your wholesale reforms. And it's hardly that's not too devious, given the fact that the very title initially of Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was itself kind of masking Congress's purposes behind the initial passing of the statute.
It's clearly an interesting area, and it's one that's not going to go away anytime soon. You know, there's very practical reasons for why there's greater FCPA scrutiny today than there was, 10, 15, 20 years ago. Among the practical reasons, of course, is there's just more international business. It's like saying there's more speeding tickets with the more drivers there are on the highway. I mean, that's completely practical. But, some of the provocative reasons, which I'm not suggesting rank one or two, but certainly are part of the total mix of information the sophisticated person needs to know about, is, this has proven to be a convenient cash cow for the U.S. government, and I'm not the only one saying that. Some of the most vocal people who have talked about this are former DOJ FCPA enforcement officials. And let's face it, there's a lot of people making a lot of money because of this new era of FCPA enforcement, and I just really don't see it changing anytime soon. You know, what's interesting is you mentioned Dodd-Frank and SOX, and to, very much there is a SOX Inc. and a Dodd-Frank Inc. Well, that happened because of a new statute. Right?
Yes.
If FCPA Inc. happened in 2010 because of a new statute, well, you could understand that better. but that's not why it happened. At that point, the FCPA was, well over, 30 years old.
Yours is really at its core a process critique. So as we're coming to the end of our time here, you don't sound too sanguine about the prospects for substantial reform, but What do you think could be done or might be done to at least subject this to greater judicial scrutiny, or to get Congress to impose, to force really the substance of its will on the DOJ, which is perhaps operating really independently here?
Yeah, I've long advocated for a two-step FCPA reform proposal. One is amending the statute itself to include a compliance defense. I don't see this as a race to the bottom. I actually see this as a race to the top. Many people are focused on what I'll just call hard enforcement, i.e. actual DOJ and SEC enforcement actions. Well, a compliance defense, I think, would have a greater impact on soft enforcement. In other words, would offer I've used the analogy before, a big juicy carrot for business organizations to adopt best in practices, compliance policies, and procedures. So I think the greatest impact of a compliance defense would not necessarily be hard enforcement, but soft enforcement.
It seems really anomalous in terms of our broad regulation of corporate activity to not have a compliance defense in this area. I mean, compliance defenses are routine in securities enforcement.
Well, exactly, and let's face it, the FCPA is part of the 34 Act, and other portions of the 34 Act, you're absolutely right, have good faith compliance defenses embedded in them. So, you know, people calling a compliance defense new or novel are, let's face it, kind of uninformed on this issue. And the second point would be to abolish MPAs and DPAs. And I think when considering whether to abolish MPAs or DPAs, it's important to consider the following facts. These are not well-ingrained, entrenched resolution vehicles that have a history in the United States of hundreds of years here. We're literally talking about recent inventions. Furthermore, we're not talking about a way of resolving criminal cases that peer countries use. The United States is really the only one currently, you know, using MPAs and DPAs. Now, because they're so easy, because they're efficient, because they lead to more enforcement, other countries are really interested in them. But, you know, I sort of warned in my 2010 article, The Facade of FCPA Enforcement, that one of the reasons why we need to correct this facade is before we know it, there's going to be a global facade of enforcement of bribery and corruption laws. And you know, the rule of law person in me and the notion that a government enforcement agency actually needs to prove things and the notion that even legal persons have due process rights and the notion that a law ought to mean what Congress intended it to mean may seem old-fashioned, but these are just, you know, principles that I firmly adhere to.
Mike, we've benefited enormously from your expertise and erudition in this area. I think that policymakers certainly will. I hope that you get another chance to testify before Congress soon, and maybe some of these reforms can really be pursued. I want to give your website again so that people, why don't you give it so that people can follow your work on this subject, and I'm sure they can link to your scholarship through that website.
Yeah, the website is fcpaprofessor.com. Among other features of the website, you'll find a link to my book and scholarship. You'll find an FCPA 101 feature. I write most consistently 5 days a week on this topic and would be happy for listeners to visit that site and to contact me through that website.
I look forward to following your work there, and perhaps we'll see some developments in this area and we can have you on the podcast again to discuss it.
Oh, I appreciate it. I enjoyed talking about this with you, so thank you.
Thanks very much, Mike.
All right, that's it. That's our interview with Professor Michael Kaler on the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. We are sponsored by the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University, and we are grateful for their sponsorship. Subscribe to us on iTunes and follow us on Twitter at David Yosifon. That's at David Yosifon, at David Yosifon. And I tweet it out whenever we post a new episode in this podcast series. I'm grateful for your time. Thanks for listening. Pursue your excellence. Enjoy it.